Heaven.
Our Father in heaven, please be with us during this class and help us to learn information which will help us in our Christian lives to follow you more closely. Please be with our instructor and help him and guide him in the class. And please be with each one of us to help us to follow you more closely every day. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Paul, I need you to tell me when I'm supposed to stop. Thank you. Oh, very good. Maybe I'll remember that's there. Well, good morning. It's nice to be with you. I have the same problem at every congregation I go, so don't feel like I just don't seem to remember those things from place to place to place. C.S. Lewis made the statement that we live in enemy-occupied territory. The Apostle John put it this way, 1 John 5:19, the whole world lies under the sway of wickedness, or of the wicked one. You know, that's always been true. It's just more obvious now than it used to be. I was reading a book some time ago by a man named Rod Dreher. That may be a name that some of you recognize. He made this statement, the culture war is largely over. And we lost. I'm not old man River, but I've lived just long enough now that I've had a little time to see some things change. And over the past 25 years or so, I've noticed a change. When we used to talk about persecution, and of course you can't study the Bible without it coming up, we would speak of persecution as something, of course, that happens in the Bible or something that's happening over in North Korea or something. And then around 25 or so years ago, I started noticing ever so seldom, but every once in a while in a conversation or from the pulpit, someone would intimate that persecution could maybe come to us. And then here in very recent years, the conversation has changed again. Persecution seems like it's likely on its way and may not be too far away. I don't want to borrow trouble, as some have said. I have no idea what the future really holds. Let me ask you, if persecution, and I'm talking about more than just, you know, alienation from people, being made fun of, not that those things don't matter, but they're not the degree of persecution we're talking about today. If persecution comes, why will it come? And I'll ask it this way, and I borrow this from Rick. Why would anyone want to hurt people like you? I mean, really? You're the best neighbors anyone could ask for. You show up to work on time. You do your job. You don't create problems. You're the person who's willing to take the shirt off his back. You're the worst person who's willing to let the other person get what they want. You're kind and loving. You don't create problems. You obey the law. You pay your taxes on time. On and on and on. Why would anyone want to hurt you? Chris?
We make them feel these other neighbors who see you as the good neighbor would probably see your success as their failure. And oftentimes they want to persecute those who they see have caused their failure.
All right.
We make them, in another way, we make them feel insufficient.
Okay, okay. I'm not going to argue with that.
Satan loves chaos.
Paul says Satan loves chaos.
If you have a comment, raise your hand. I'll bring you the mic.
Okay. No one said it.
I said, I think because we're following Jesus.
And that's a good blanket answer because everything we're going to talk about would connect back to that. Let me suggest that another possible... all these are true answers in one respect or another, but I think they can all be boiled down to one thing. And it's a five-letter word. Truth. What did Paul ask the Galatians? Galatians chapter 4, verse 16, he said, have I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? Why would he ask that? Because what's usually the answer to that question? Yeah. The answer is usually yes. You and I affirm offensive truths. We say that gender and sex are actually the same thing and that there are only two of them. We say that homosexuality and transgenderism are not acceptable to God. And we don't say that because that's what we think. We say that because that's what God says. We say there's only one true religion. We say that there is absolute truth concerning right and wrong, that all can know the truth, and that all are accountable to God to live according to that truth. And these are truths that are offensive in our time. They've always been offensive to some, and some of them used to be offensive to almost everybody. But they are offensive, or pardon me, they used to not be offensive to hardly anybody, but now they've become offensive to a much larger group of people. And how big a group that's going to get, I don't know. But it's all rooted in this right here. You say, well, isn't there supposed to be a race between those two words? No. Critical race theory, which has gotten so much attention in the recent years, is just one child, and I'm sure some of you may know this, but it's just one child in a rather large philosophical family that's been growing since the 1960s, though its roots stretch much farther back than that. And Chris, did you have a comment?
I was actually going to confirm you because I've looked on college websites and you are not wrong. There is critical race theory classes because it's become sort of a curriculum. But then you have, and I'm going to list off some things out there, critical female theory, critical queer theory, critical race theory. What's the other one? Critical identity theory, like a general overlap for everything else. But yeah, you are not wrong. It is critical theory of any kind that teaches really, really out there stuff. And it's more than just race.
All right. You've obviously looked into this a little bit. Postmodernism, that's a term many of us have heard. Postmodernism initially arose in the 1960s. Some of you lived through that. And by the way, you know, something I have come to appreciate, which I didn't used to realize, is that, you know, there are these things that happen in the ivory towers in universities. And it's very easy to think to ourselves, well, that's way over there. Those people are in their own little world. That has nothing to do with our world. But I have learned that that is not true. And the reason it's not true is very simple and straightforward. Why are some of the ideas that get taught there, why don't they stay there? Because, of course, they're teaching all these people. And these people go out of the universities and they take their ideas with them. And they eventually get into places of responsibility and they end up creating curriculum. They end up creating the mission statements. They end up creating the training and the ideas gradually get embedded in the society. Postmodernism initially arose in the 1960s. Its rise is associated with several French theorists. I don't think you probably want to know their names. If you do, feel free to come and talk to me. It's difficult to summarize, but one of its core tenets is something we've become very familiar with, and it's the rejection of absolute truth, or at least the ability to know truth. The idea is that, you know, maybe there is absolute truth out there, but if there is, we have no way of defining, we have no way of ascertaining it, so we live as if there is no absolute truth. So the line between what is objectively true and what is objectively experienced, something we try to teach our children at a very young age, this ceased to be accepted. After all, there's no way to test your truth against mine. And so the result of this among those who took it to its logical conclusion, think about that. If you believe that there's absolutely no absolute truth, or if there is, I have no way of knowing it, what is your life going to become like if you're a person who thinks? And there are people who took this very seriously, and they took it to its logical conclusion. What's the logical conclusion of seeing life that way? Think about it. You get up in the morning and you've got these certain things you want to do. You've got certain things you want to accomplish in life, certain things you may feel like are important. But then you think, yes, but I know I've deconstructed all of this and none of this. I have no reason to believe that any of this is real, that any of this is matters, that any of this is significant. What kind of feelings and views about your life are going to set in? All right, chaos would definitely be part of it, sure.
Negativity, like a feeling of gloom and doom.
Absolutely. And that is exactly what happened. Among the people who took this to its logical conclusion, there was this growing pessimism, cynicism, nothing really matters at all, and people weren't made to live that way. So postmodernism, this pure postmodernism, burned out by the mid-80s. But you had this huge philosophical framework, and what are we as humans like? If we've come to believe a whole set of ideas, how many of us like to give them all up? All right. So a new set of theorists arose in the late 80s and early 90s. And they took postmodernism and they said, okay, this isn't working, but we don't want to let all of this go. We think there's some good stuff here. So postmodernism morphed, and it took what's been called an applied turn, which is a fancy way of saying, here's this thing that really had no practical value, but we're going to give it practical value. From the ashes of early postmodernism arose a new set of theorists whose mission was to take those core tenets of postmodernism and apply them to the world so that we could reconstruct a better world. And from them came queer theory, post-colonial theory, and critical race theory. When did you first hear about critical race theory? I mean, let's put a year on it. Approximately, when did we first start hearing about critical race theory?
I started hearing it in just watching just like modern news stations. I started hearing around 2018 or something like that,
okay.
Early 2018.
Okay, anybody further back than that? Kurt, when did you hear about it?
About 2006.
Okay, all right. So he's got his pulse on the culture a little bit more. Sam's got a comment over here, Chris. Oh, interesting. All right.
So I didn't hear that much.
He said 1970. All right. So now, that's an interesting answer because that name had not yet been coined, but the ideology was growing. That's true. If you've ever heard black liberation theology, which was big in the 60s and 70s, it definitely contained some of these ideas. But that term, critical race theory, was coined in 1989. A group of people who were kind of espousing some of these ideas, they were academics, they all got together up in Madison, Wisconsin. They got together in a convent, ironically, and there were some reasons for that. Richard Delgado, who was one of them, he said it was an odd place for a bunch of Marxists, which was very interesting. They got together, they talked about the different things they believed, and they kind of laid out, okay, here are some core ideas, and they gave it a name, critical race theory. But it grew out of postmodernism, as did queer theory, as did postcolonial theory, and when it did, postmodernism became moral. Now you say, whoa, 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 if something says there's no absolute truth, how can it be moral? Well, they decided they had to acknowledge some truth. What truth do they acknowledge? Well, they all began to coalesce around an idea that was parallel to Descartes' statement. I think, therefore I am. You know, philosophy, you might be listening to this and you go, John sounds like he's kind of interested in philosophy. Well, not terribly much so. I'm interested in what's going on in the culture. And to do that, you kind of end up having to pay attention to this, at least in our time. But philosophy has really never been something that interested me a great deal. Jeremy Morris, my nephew, we were in college together down in Springfield in the early 90s, and he had a roommate who was a philosophy major. His name was Chuck. I remember eating lunch with him one day, and he was telling me about this stuff he's studying and thinking about. Philosophy I suppose it can be interesting, and yet it's kind of sad at the same time, because what is a philosopher ultimately trying to accomplish? Yeah, they're trying to arrive at truth about reality. What am I here? Where am I headed? Blah, blah, blah. And to get there, what are they using?
Their own ideas.
Yeah. It's man trying to arrive at truth on his own power. And that's a dead-end road. Descartes came to that realization, I know I exist because I think. You know, you hear that and you're like, seriously? Yes. I'm thinking, therefore I must exist. Well, these theorists, they said, okay, we know there's a thing called oppression. We know there's people who are experiencing suffering. So there must be a thing called oppression. Because suffering is being created by oppression, and if there's oppression, there must be someone or something that's oppressing. I experience oppression, therefore I am, and so also are dominance and oppression. And once it was determined that there is such a thing as oppression, and of course oppression is bad, then there was a need to right that oppression, to fix it. It's a great injustice. Enter social justice. The oppressed should be liberated. Gender studies, gender ideology, disability studies, and yes, in the academic world, it's called fat studies. All of these things, along with the three I've already mentioned, are a part of this critical theory. They all grow out of it. And they all have certain premises on which they're built. And our job is not to change the culture. Our job is not to save the country. But it may behoove us to understand where these people are coming from. So that's what I'd like to spend a little time doing today. Talk about what this is, that they're what they're really saying, why they're saying it, and we'll look at it in light of Scripture as we go along. One of the core tenets of this view of the world, regardless of its queer theory, critical race theory, any of them, they're all based on these same ideas, is called one of the first and most important things among these systems is what's called the social binary. 1848, Karl Marx published the Communist Manifesto. If memory serves, 5,000 copies rolled off a London press. And the Communist Manifesto begins with these words. The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. In a word, oppressor and oppressed. This was Karl Marx's view of society's history up until his time. That you can boil it down to this. Everyone falls into either the category of oppressor or oppressed. So critical theory takes this. It builds on Karl Marx's conflict theory, and critical theorists say the following. The whole world is a power play. Let me read to you from one of the textbooks. This book is put out by Oslem Sensoy and Robin DiAngelo. If you've heard of the book White Fragility, Robin DiAngelo is the one who wrote this book. This book is called, Is Everyone Really Equal? An Introduction to Key Concepts in Social Justice Education. It promotes this. I have it at home. If any of you are interested in taking a peek at it. But on page 203 in this book, which is one of the most influential college textbooks currently being used to train future educators in our country right now, it says the following. The societal default is oppression. There are no spaces free from it. Did you hear what that was just said? It's in a textbook. The societal default, in other words, unless someone comes at society from the outside and does something to change it, this is how people function. Oppression. And there are no spaces free from it. So if you're at work, if you're in a family, if you're in a country, if you're in a church, oppression is going on. They go on to say the question becomes, how is it manifesting here rather than is it manifesting here? To those who hold this worldview, they come in and they sit down in here and they engage with you. Their question is not, is there oppression in this church? Their question is, where is it? And we need to identify it and address it. Well, how do you know if you're in an oppressed or oppressor group? Well, number one, it is about groups. And it falls along the lines of you've heard it all before, race, white, black, class, rich, poor, age, gender, cisgender, that's if you identify as the same gender as you have biologically, and transgender. Sex, male, female. Parent, child. Did you know that? That according to this view, parents are oppressors of their children? Google it. Or duck-duck-go it. I'm not a fan of Google. But check it out. These power dynamics, they say, they are there, that's without question. And the only reason you don't notice them, well, there's a number of reasons for that. But basically the reason you don't know about it is you have not yet been awakened. You have not had it deconstructed and illuminated for you. But once you become awakened to them, you are...
Whoa.
Have you ever heard terms like this? Implicit bias, glass ceiling, covert racism. Do you notice how all those words are indicating that there's something you don't see? It's all rooted in this. You need to have your eyes opened by those who do understand, those with the special knowledge, so that you can see things for what they really are. And when you see it through the right glasses, you'll see that everyone's oppressed or an oppressor. They see the world as contained of groups. We shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ that what? Anybody remember how Paul puts it? That each one may receive the things done in the body. If I receive heaven or hell, for whose actions will I receive that? Mine. I am not held accountable for your bad or your good. And you will not be for mine. In critical theory, the individual is something like the sum total of the identity groups to which that person simultaneously belongs. You are an exemplar. You are an example or a sample of a particular identity group. I'm John, yes. But according to this view of the world, what's of first importance is that I'm a white, heterosexual, cisgender, able-bodied Protestant male. And these facts alone, taking into account nothing about me as an individual, these facts alone have the power to determine whether I am guilty or innocent. Listen to what Peggy McIntosh, in her work, White Privilege and Male Privilege, listen to what she said. Quote, "My schooling gave me no training in seeing myself as an oppressor. I was taught," and she means wrongly, "I was taught to see myself as an individual whose moral state depended on her individual moral will." In this view of the world, it's not about what you as an individual have consciously done. It's about the groups to which you belong. By the way, if you view the world that way, so let's say Paul Walker walks in the door and I don't know Paul, but I hold this world view. Well, I see Paul's walking, so he's able-bodied. He's a white male, just walked into a church building, so he's a Christian. And so I make a whole bunch of determinations about Paul, about whether he's oppressor or oppressed, whether he's in the right or wrong. I don't know his name. I don't know anything about the way he lives, how he would treat me, but I've made a judgment about him. You see how Christianity and this worldview are not compatible. And I have spoken with a Christian who held this view. It was a few years back, and I didn't really understand this stuff yet, and I don't know that this person really understood how they had drunk the Kool-Aid. But this individual was being very critical of brethren. You know, there's not enough people of certain races among the brethren, and so forth. And looking back on it, I wonder how much attention that individual was paying to people as individuals. It didn't really seem like a whole lot. It was all about groups and categories. This view says that truth, and I'm going to put it in quotes and I'll explain why in a moment. It says that they are social constructs. What's that mean? Each culture, according to this view, constructs or produces its own truth and knowledge. And if you operate according to that truth and that knowledge, that will allow you to function successfully within that culture, the culture that produced that truth and knowledge. But what's true within one culture does not remain true if you step into another culture. Theory insists that no one set of cultural norms can be said to be better than any other. Here's how the people who teach it say it. Critical theory calls into question the idea that objectivity is desirable or even possible. The term used to describe this way of thinking about knowledge is that knowledge is socially constructed. By that we mean That knowledge is reflective of the values and interests of those who produce it. Is knowledge produced? I hear a no. Well, how would you describe it? If I have knowledge, how did I get that? Well, I'm asking weird questions, aren't I? Well, yes. But let's say knowledge even beyond. But yes, absolutely. But how did we learn it from God? Okay, yeah. Didn't we discover it? Knowledge is reality. And it's something that is discovered, not created. Now, granted, we might argue that God created reality, of course, because He created the heavens and the earth. But beyond that, we discover truth. We acquire and discover knowledge. We don't create it. But according to this view, it is created. Each culture creates its own knowledge and truth, consummate with its values. All content and all means of knowing are connected to a social context. So how far is this taken? Shay Akil McLean, who upholds this worldview, says the following. The idea of objectivity, and what's objectivity, by the way? That's the second time I've used this word. What's objectivity? If I'm being objective, what am I being? All right. And I'm looking at them without
bias.
That's the idea. To just take the facts and let them stand. That's why Justice has her blindfold on. She's just hearing the facts and she's going to make a judgment based on those facts and not going to be biased. That's the idea. This view, this author says, the idea of objectivity in Western intellectual traditions is problematic. And notice, by the way, in Western intellectual traditions. That's the culture that produced this idea of objectivity. It's problematic for many reasons. And to think that there are universal truths, this perpetuates a particular kind of able-bodied, white, cisgender, male logic. Did you hear that? So the idea that truth is something that's absolute and we need to arrive at it objectively and not be subjective about it and just accept truth as it is and that it be true for everybody, this comes from white, able-bodied, male logic. That's where that truth, quote unquote, arose from. Judith Katz and her diversity curriculum that's used by some of the biggest companies in the world. Here's what she says. Objective, rational, linear thinking. Controlled emotions, the scientific method, quantitative research. These are all defining marks of white culture. She goes on to add, the idea that individual has primary responsibility. Who teaches that, that the individual has the primary responsibility? Who ultimately teaches us that? God, of course. But that idea, along with working hard, brings success. Planning for the future. Delayed gratification, owning goods, space, and property. The nuclear family is the ideal unit, and belief in Christianity. These are components of white culture. And you see now why this begins to matter to you and me. This isn't about saving America. This isn't about saving the culture. But in this view, what you and I believe, this grows out of a particular culture. It's not true for other cultures. It grows out of a particular culture, and it happens to be the culture you and I have bought into and are a part of, as they see it. And it's oppressive. Each culture produces its own knowledge. Each is equal in verity and value to all the others. The knowledges are equal, and the ways of arriving at them are equal. Critical theory argues that legitimate knowledge can be gained in a number of different ways. Here's how one professor puts it. We must learn to trust our own senses, to trust our own feelings and experiences, and to give them authority. Okay, what does the Bible teach us about following the heart?
It's not within man to direct his own steps.
All right, absolutely. It's not within me. That's right. Jeremiah, I remember where that is. Yes. It's not within man to direct his own steps. What else?
That sort of living is fickle. It changes. It can change with the wind at a moment's notice.
The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? He who trusts in his own heart is a Ooh, this is what the Bible says. Now, does that mean we should ignore emotions? No. I will say every generation has its faults. And I think, you know, what will future generations, if the Lord tarries, they'll look back on my generation and what will they say, you know? I'm sure I know of some things my generation as a whole is missing. I'm sure there are things I'm missing that we're missing. But I do think this is one area that maybe we have been at fault a little bit. You know, if someone is feeling something, that should matter to me if they matter to me. Now, do their feelings necessarily reflect truth? Well, they may or may not. Because I can be very... Well, remember Elijah? Elijah's on his way down to Sinai from Carmel, and he says, Lord, I'm no better than my fathers. In other words, I'm a failure here. I did all this work, and they're still following Baal. I'm no better than my fathers. I'm all alone. Take my life. Now, that's depression. I am a failure. I am all alone. I want to die. Why did Elijah believe that he was all alone? He was very upset about this. I'm all alone. But my point is, was he all alone?
No.
Yeah, what did God tell him? You remember the details, Chris? It was more than 300. 7,000! There are 7,000 in Israel who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So here was Elijah, very despondent and very upset. Were those feelings real? You better believe they were. Did they matter? They sure did to God, because when God came and spoke to him, how did God speak to him? In a still, small voice. You ever notice that? God didn't come to him speaking like thunder as he had during Jesus' ministry. God didn't come to him speaking as he did from Mount Sinai when he issued the Ten Commandments, and the people said to Moses, we don't even want to hear him anymore. You speak to him and you come and tell us what he said. He comes to Elijah and he speaks to him in a still, small voice. Why? Because that's how Elijah needed to be addressed at that time. God cared about his emotions, God cared about Elijah, and he treated him in a certain way in light of that, but he also told him, Elijah, I know you feel this way, but your reasons for feeling this way are wrong. And that helped Elijah. Believing the truth helped Elijah get to where he needed to be. This view says no. The feelings are to be treated as indicators of truth. Social justice scholarship argues that reason and evidence-based knowledge are unfairly favored over tradition, folklore, interpretation, and emotion. And this is why. Partly, the quest for objectivity in their view is tantamount to a quest for white supremacy. Listen to what one professor said. A request for evidence of oppression... A request for evidence of oppression is itself a form of exploitation, injustice, and oppression. What is he saying? He's saying that if someone comes along, or some group in this view, and they say, we are oppressed, and you say, what's your evidence for that? The moment you say that, that itself is a form of oppression. Why is that a form of oppression? Because that's just you applying your culture's truth and knowledge to them. And you shouldn't do that. There are other ways of knowing. How they feel, what they believe they've experienced, these things have equal value, and it's oppressive for you to put your value set on them. They take this quite a ways. In the field of academia, there is today a thing called research justice. And in this view, there's a moral obligation to share the prestige of rigorous research with other forms of research. Superstition, spiritual beliefs, cultural traditions and beliefs, identity-based experiences, emotional responses. These are all to be put right up there with the rigorous research that we expect from our universities and colleges. And transgenderism is probably one of the most notable examples of this in our time. 2007, there was a gathering of self-styled human rights experts in Yogyakarta, Indonesia. They were LGBT activists, and they drew up a series of demands. And these demands came to be known as the Yogyakarta Principles. This is 2007. One of you said 2006. In these they said. Now this is before it was really on the radar of almost anyone on planet Earth. But it was on their radar. They said that a person's gender identity was defined as a person's deeply felt internal and individual experience of gender. Now, I will say a few things about this. Is it true that some people have these feelings where they genuinely feel like they are another gender? Yes, that is true, that they have those feelings. Now, transgenderism and homosexuality are not the same thing by any means. But I'm going to point out a parallel once. I was meeting with a man who struggles with same-sex attraction. This man is a Christian, but he has these feelings. And I'll never forget him hanging his head and saying, I want to be normal. He did not ask for these feelings. There's a long story of where I think they came from. He is not asking for them. He did not want them, but he was having them. So we need to acknowledge that reality. There are people who feel this way, and they didn't ask for it. Now, there are others who may be asking for it. We do have kind of a cultural contagion going on right now, but that's not true of all of them by any means. There are the activists who are pushing all this stuff, and then there are the people in the trenches who really do have these feelings. But again, does that make it true? We know the answer to that question. And that's where we part ways with the critical theorists. These people in 2007 were saying, that's their identity. That's truth as they see it, and it should be recognized and acknowledged. Now there's one other way of knowing I'll just put up here. We've kind of already touched on it. Lived experience. Fancy word for this is standpoint epistemology, but what it boils down to is this. I believed I experienced it, and it is therefore true. I believe I experienced it, and it is therefore true. And it operates on two assumptions. The first of those is this. If you've got people who all occupy the same social positions, so, you know, I didn't get into this when we were there, but if you've heard the word intersectionality, it has to do with, okay, you've got all these different oppressed groups and oppressor groups, and one person might, and no one's just one. So let's say, in this view, you're a male. Well, that puts you in an oppressor group. But if you are a black male, now you are part of an oppressor and a part of an oppressed group. There's an intersection of different identity groups in your life, and that shapes your experience. That's the view of things here. Well, in critical theory, this idea of lived experience says that if you've got someone who occupies the same social positions as others, and that they are going to have the same experiences, it's not possible for you to be in an oppressed group and not have oppressed experiences. And you might say, well, there are people who say they don't have oppressed experiences. Well, that's because they don't understand their own experiences correctly. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. It also says that your position within that social power dynamic, whether you are among the oppressor or the oppressed, that this dictates what you can and cannot know. So you say, well, if lived experience is a source of truth, we've all got our own lived experiences, yes, but if you are in an oppressor group, your lived experiences are not reliable because of your privilege. But if you are in the oppressed group, you already understand the dominant position, and you have the experience of being oppressed by it, so you have a kind of double sight. James Cone was the father of black liberation theology, which I mentioned earlier, which carried some of these ideas. Here's what he said. And I cite this only to illustrate how far they take this. He said, whites are incapable of making any valid judgments about human existence. And that, of course, is because, according to this view, the group is in this privileged category, and their privilege blinds them from possessing reliable knowledge about those in the oppressed category. So now there was that statement that if you're in a certain group of identities, everybody in those identity groups is going to have the same experience of oppression if they understand their experiences correctly. Hegemony is how that word's pronounced. It comes from the Greek word hegemon, which means ruler. Matthew 27:2, this is what Pilate is called in the Greek. I think King James translates it governor, but it means ruler. And the idea of hegemony is that, particularly cultural hegemony is what's under consideration here, that when a dominant group, all right, so we've got all those oppressor groups that we've talked about in this worldview. So if those groups are the dominant culture, as it's asserted they are in the United States, then they impose their norms, their values, their expectations, their truth. They impose it on the rest of the society, and they rule in that way. Bear with me for a moment while I take us down a little historical trip for just a second. This concept, and we're going to talk about it in multiple ways here, but it was borrowed from an Italian philosopher by the name of Antonio Gramsci. Gramsci was the founder of the Communist Party in Italy. So he thought a lot about what Karl Marx wrote. And he was sitting there contemplating, okay, I think he died in 1937, 1939. Didn't live a very old, long life. He died something around 45 or 46. But he was contemplating, he said, you know, Marx predicted that there was going to be an uprising of the workers, the proletariat. The proletariat was going to rise up and throw off the yoke of the bourgeoisie. He predicted this, and I think Marx was right in his philosophy, but the uprising never happened. So Gramsci was like, why is that? Why didn't the workers who were oppressed, why didn't they rise up? They never did it. Why was there no revolution? And he said, I think it was because, or may have been because, of cultural hegemony. He said, all the social institutions, the schools, the churches, the courts, the media, the family, marriage, they were all pushing the values and the beliefs of the ruling class. And because all the institutions were pushing this and the workers were a part of those institutions, they ended up believing them. So you have the truth and the knowledge of the dominant class that's being pushed through all the institutions. And since the oppressed were in those institutions, they're getting all these norms and values pushed on them from the dominant class, and they ended up buying into them. And so they were conditioned to stay right where the dominant class wanted them. And they basically thought, well, I'm right where I'm supposed to be. This is where I belong. And so they got conditioned, and they didn't revolt because of that. So let me ask you, if you believe that, if you believe the oppressed are being held down and are basically being brainwashed by the institutions, and that's keeping them from revolting as they should, how would you try to fix it? If you believed the schools and the churches and the government and all these various institutions were pressing ideas from an oppressive culture, and those ideas are what's holding people down, how would you try to fix it, Chris?
You would try to force the revolution by eradicating those norms and truths pushed by the quote-unquote ruling class.
All right. You would definitely try to override those truths, but violence has been found not to work in these instances. There have been attempts, and they haven't worked because... And I'm getting off of for just a little bit, but the capitalism is very flawed because people are flawed, but it makes life pretty good for the middle class, and that's what they found. They can't get workers to revolt. So what if it's the ideas that are holding people down, how would you get those ideas changed?
As you said, they make them out to be evil and wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to have to get into the institutions, aren't you? Yeah.
But just to clarify, I wasn't talking about violence, like actual fighting revolution. I was saying like mental revolution.
All right.
They forced it. They tried to force it that way.
That's true. And it's been very gradual. But that's what's been going on. And that's why we're at the point we're at now. And, you know, some of you are past the point where you're worrying about where your children are going to go to school. But if you're thinking about your grandchildren, you know, I don't know what kind of influence you could have, you know, and that sort of thing. But these are things I think... those of us who are parents, and there are a few of us in the room, do need to be aware of. Bethany, we live about 25 minutes from the parking lot of UCM, and so it's been very convenient for us when we moved out there in the sticks. And Bethany's first semester at UCM, she comes home, and she's telling us the stuff that she's hearing. And then Peter goes, and we get textbooks, and they're bringing textbooks home that are pornographic. And, you know, these are things to just be aware of, you know. And I'm not saying it's wrong to send children to public school. I'm not going to say that. But I think we are at a point in our culture now where in many places to send them to those schools is to throw them to the lions. So this is what's going on. They've gotten to the institutions. They're pushing this stuff. And it's to bring about the revolt. And they seem to be having some success. Go ahead, Chris.
It was just something I heard while coming here, while listening to the radio, and it was a preacher on there, so I know, take it with a grain of salt, but he did point out a fact that I have heard before. School officials, like superintendents and stuff like that, are beginning to become offended when parents say they have a right to know what their child is learning. So, yeah. you're talking truth here. So, that's all I was gonna say.
Yeah, and that's been part of the approach all along.
I have a question, and then I also have a comment. Is it the dominant, all of these ideas that are coming out from these groups?
Yes.
In my mind, that comes under the umbrella of politics. Is that a fair statement? A true statement or not? The reason I ask that question is mm-hmm. because right after I had started working full time, I was, you know, 20, 22 or something, 21, and I was working. My job was at the junior college, and the chancellor came out to the campus and held this employee meeting, and he said something that just flabbergasted me. And the one thing that he said was, education is political. And if you don't think it is, you are terribly, terribly mistaken. It is from the money down to what is taught. And that's what he said. And so I've kind of, in my mind, I've held that as a where some of our politics is coming from, or, I mean, in my mind, it is politics. I mean, it directs what our government associations or the things that they're pushing and funding and mm-hmm. going along with, you know, from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why I ask about the category of politics
mm-hmm.
and some of the areas where we need to be paying attention to what they're saying and what they're asking for and, you know, the influences that they have.
I appreciate that. I don't think I have the intelligence to put together a concise answer to your question with the time we have left, but I'll say this. First of all, our interest here this morning is not politics. Our interest here is living a godly life in times like these. Does it behoove us to understand some things about the times? Yes. And yet, these cultural forces that are at work, yes, they are intersecting with politics, and they are using those powers to bring about their end. So we are affected by politics. We're not here to worry about politics, but we are affected by it. So, yeah, definitely. And, you know, this is demand. This is totalitarianism. This is how it works. Totalitarianism is not just dictatorship. Dictatorship says, I will control your actions. And that's no fun. We don't want that. But totalitarianism goes one step further. I will control your actions, and I want your mind, too. And that's why these institutions are so important to them, and that's why these things are being pushed everywhere, because they want us to think a certain way, and it's going to affect, it affects your entire life. There's no area where it's not affected as they see it, and we're already past the time I was supposed to be talking. Kurt, go ahead and make your comment real quick, and then, I should have opened the floor sooner.
Being in the workforce the last 20 years, I've been dealing with the new ideologies for a very long time, kind of a clash of the old with a clash of the new. I've worked with baby boomers and younger generations at the same time. What's interesting is the irony is that Karl Marx was a white, cisgendered male, which exactly. They derive all their...
The revolutionaries always from. Are.
It's amazing. They'll follow him, but then say, I can't have an opinion, whatever. Second, it's not politics because they're all in on it. To say that one group is better than the other when they all benefit from the same contributions, they all come from the same people. You're right, it does affect us, but should we even discuss it? Is it even worth the time discussing? The problem is that they're right, but they're also wrong. It's just they're misguided. There is a dichotomy. There's, you either live in the spirit or you live in the flesh. There are two. Everything is binary. You're either with God or you're against Him, right? Isn't that what the scripture says? So these ideas are not really from man. It's, the problem is, it's man stealing those ideas and saying they're my own and I'm God. My feelings matter. That's where the problem is. God's feelings matter more. What he says matters more, yes? There are two groups of people. There's the Jew and the Gentile, really. Race doesn't matter. That's sitting in these pews as a child, I learned race didn't matter because it was presented to the Jew first and then the Gentile. Christianity crushes this whole ideology as long as you remember that God's in charge and his son is the Christ.
Yeah, it's incompatible with Christianity, that's right. And that's why it views Christianity as a threat, which we'll talk a little bit during the lesson time. I appreciate your attention. I'm sorry I went over.